Actor Room, where me and Gareth warble on for a while about film, television and cinema. And this is the point at which Gareth tells me off for saying me and Gareth.
Yes, Ted, you should know better.
You're right. Is it hot? Is it hot there as it is here?
I believe it is sitting at about 24 degrees today. We're okay, although we have officially qualified for heat wave as of today. But no, it's quite nice in comparison to poor old Ted, folks. Ted's got it hard at the moment. I don't mean it that way.
I've got my air conditioner on now, and I hope you can't hear it. It's gone down from 26 to 22 in the last half an hour, so 22 is not bad. I can live with that. Yes. Anyway, there you go. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website, and GarethMiles.com is where you can find Gareth, and TedSalmon.com is where you can find me. Bit of feedback from the group first, in the MeWe group on this occasion. Phil Harding has been watching Sylvain Chomet. And I reviewed on this very show years ago the L'Allusionist, which you might remember. This is Chomet's animations. He's been watching Belleville Rendezvous, or the Twins of Belleville, I think it's called, and
the triplets,
like, yeah, and the Illusionist, and I thought they were great. As I say, I watched them back in the day, and we spoke about it on the show. But that's fine. We can revisit it now with Phil, who has stumbled across a double DV on his shelf, he says, and he thought he would revisit as a double bill. Thankfully, both of these mostly dialogue-free animation films have aged beautifully. On the surface, they share quite similar themes. Both follow gifted but reserved performers, a cyclist and a musician, from modest backgrounds trying to navigate an obnoxious, confusing world. They also center on surrogate parent-child dynamics, a devoted grandmother and her grandson in Belleville, and a weary magician acting as a father figure to a young girl in the L'Allusionist. It goes without saying that the hand-drawn animation is gorgeous, brilliantly evoking the specific eras and places they depict. I was particularly impressed by L'Allusionist's atmospheric rendering of late 1950s Edinburgh. I think this is exactly what I said, I think, when I reviewed it. That Edinburgh thing is really, really impressive, the way that they've captured that. And the hotel he stays in, which is run by and full of these kind of thespians. And it's just really, really well done. A quick word of warning, both films employ some rather broad cultural stereotypes that might raise an eyebrow. Though the kilt-wearing, inebriated Scotsman in The Illusionist is an absolute scene-stealer. If you haven't seen these gems, I highly recommend them. They remain some of the finest and most poignant adult-focused animation films of the last two decades. And I agree. Absolutely. Yes. And I'll put a link to my review into the show notes as well. I think you knew both of these as well, didn't you?
I did indeed, but I'm a bit concerned that you might be sitting a bit too close to your microphone, because when you said poignant, it was almost like you were spitting down my ear.
Let me move back.
Do that. I haven't seen Triplets of Belleville in a long time, but I remember being struck by it when it came out. And I remember something about the soundtrack to it, I think, the music that they use was really attention-grabbing for me. I was totally motivated by the music to watch it, but I can't remember too much of it now. And I know we've discussed it a few times, and I still haven't had the inkling to go and actually sit down and watch it again, but maybe I will. I too, Phil, have a DVD of it, and I might dig it out, because I've been digging out DVDs recently.
Yeah, I might revisit it. As Phil says, it's aged beautifully, and I haven't seen either of them now for about, I think, about 6 years. I think my review was done in 2018. So, yes, I Well done, Phil. Prompted us both to go and do that. Okay, flop of the fortnight. I'm going to put in The Last Voyage of Demeter.
No! Don't tell me so!
Sorry if that upsets you, but I watched it last week, and I was up for a kind of vampire kind of fest, and it was just so... It was very Disney-like, I thought. And the set was just, like, so obviously in a studio, and that all the water scenes were done in a huge water tank, which I've subsequently researched, and that is true. The whole thing, you know, nothing of it is actually on the sea anywhere. And you have this stupid thing where you see the sea, which is completely wild and huge storm going on, and then they cut to someone walking down a corridor, and they're just walking down the corridor as if it's in a place on land, and that whole kind of thing just, it didn't work for me at all. I thought it was really bad. I thought the sets were done badly, and it was just so obvious that it was lowish budget, and it felt just very Disney, I thought. And also the special effects, I wasn't impressed with. I thought that the Dracula makeup was kind of rubbery and digital looking to a degree, not at all horrifying or terrifying. So there was that, and it was just like, I say it was low budget, but apparently it cost $45 million to make. Where's that money gone? I don't know. Perhaps they paid the actors the money. And the cast was solid, I think, but the script just kind of gave them nothing to work with. It was so badly written and scripted, yeah. And the actors were just kind of overcompensating by being all loud and theatrical. I don't know. I just didn't like it. I thought it was cheaply done and badly done. And what I kept thinking was Disney. So defend it.
I can't yet. I haven't seen it. there's two reasons why I haven't seen it. One, because I kind of forgot about it. And two, because I don't have it. So I will. I'll get to it in okay. The weeks to come. Yes.
You do that and tell me I'm wrong.
I look forward to hopefully telling you that you're wrong. I don't want to agree with you on this one at all. One thing you will definitely agree with me is that Just Friends is shit. Sorry, it's lousy. This was a 2005 romantic comedy, directed by Richard Cumbel, starring Ryan Reynolds, who I've had enough of. I think most people have. Amy Smart, who I can never have enough of. Anna Faris, who I can take or leave. And Chris Klein, who's in it. Julie Haggerty from Airplane 1 and 2 is also in a fairly small role, unfortunately. I got excited when I saw her name in the start credits and then thought, damn it, when it ended and she'd only been in maybe 3 scenes and they were quite short. She didn't have too many lines. But this is a comedy about Ryan Reynolds being young, overweight, and nerdy, and wearing a retainer, because, you know, retainer and braces, they're really funny. And they get lots of laughs out of the fact that he has a retainery brace type thing, or a plate, as we call them here. I never had one. I actually wanted them because my friends had them. I felt a bit left out, but I was just blessed with perfect teeth. Aside from this one, it's been broken on Paula Gibson's braces. They grow up, they're best friends when they're young, and they grow up, and it cuts to Ryan Reynolds whenever he's 10 years older and he's playing ice hockey and he's hot and fit. He's got abs and pecs everywhere. And he decided luck would have it, he ends up going back home to a place that he hasn't been in 10 years, even for Christmas. He goes back home and he reconnects with everyone that he has been he used to be friends with, and he falls in love with Amy Smart, and they get all romantic and stuff like that. And there's pratfalls along the way whenever his ultimate sort of kind of nerdiness still exists and he can't help himself. He's not as suave and cool as he thinks he is out in LA with all the models and stuff where he's been spending the last 10 years. What the film actually has is a horrible set of jokes about all kinds of awful things that, you know, it's unfair to laugh at today. This is made in 2005, so it's 21 years old, which is unbelievable. But watching it now, you know, there's a part where Anna Faris is pulling off Ryan Reynolds' trousers as he says, no, I don't want to do this, and she continues to. And, you know, that's a sexual assault. And it's funny. Because it's a girl doing that to a guy. If it was the other way around, it wouldn't be funny. It would be sexual assault, and he'd end up in prison, where he'd be fending off people trying to do the same thing, to be honest, to his hot bod. I think I smirked once during this, and at that, it was... Oh, I can't even remember what it was. It was such a mild, pathetic little gag that would be a decent or a semi-decent gag in a much funnier film. And I honestly have been thinking about it, and I've been talking to people about this over the last few days to see if anyone can actually say that they enjoyed this. And of those that have seen it, they either don't remember it in the slightest, or they had convulsions and threw up a couple of testes out of their mouths. It's woeful. Oh, it's so painful. And I really feel bad for Amy Smart, because she just got lumbered with all these crap romantic comedies when she's so much better than them. You know, Anna Faris, she went on to the Scary Movies and things and became a real sort of comedy icon. But she's nowhere near as talented an actress as Amy Smart is. And then Chris Klein, who you know from, well, you don't, but the listeners probably do, from American Pie, and I think he was in one of the Street Fighter movies, maybe. But he's just, you know, he's there because he's a handsome guy and that's it. He's got nothing really else to offer aside from being handsome. And then there's a bit of a plot twist, and he has to play it a slightly different way. But it's totally undemanding of anything. There's no substance whatsoever. Everything comes together in a completely illogical way. It's awful. They're all awful people who you never want to be in your life with, or you want to have in your life. And it just is, it's terrible. It's got Friends in the title, and it's not. It's not about people that you would want to be friends with. It's painful. Absolutely painful. Dare I ask if you've seen this?
No, and I will never see it. But I do quite like, I think you're right about her, Amy Smart. She's not really on my radar, but she was quite cute looking as the trailer rolled there while you were talking. So, yeah.
Well, if you watch something like The Butterfly Effect or Crank, she's much better in those. And there was a Road Trip? She was good on Road Trip. And then we watched a film here with herself and Thora Birch about hurricanes, I think it was. It was a natural disaster. 13 Minutes, that's what it was called.
Oh, right.
No, it wasn't 13 Minutes. Sorry, it was something like that. It had a number in it, if memory serves. I can't remember. Anyway.
What was it about?
Natural disasters. I think that it was 13 seconds or something like that, where you've got 13 seconds in which to react to
a tornado. Oh, yeah. I do remember the time. Oh, there it is. 13 minutes. It's third from the bottom. That was probably because I scored it really badly, and you and Alan, four families
No, it was a bit pants, that film. It was a bad TV movie.
Passed across a defining survival. Yeah. Vaguely remember it. Yes. Right, okay then. So we won't watch that. Just Friends.
Yes,
Let's move
just
to
crap.
Fandom Focus instead, where you can bang on about who you are a fan of because you
Oh.
it's your turn.
Fair enough. As Ted informed me before the show started, we've actually covered this fella in our theme treats back in 2023, quite early on in 2023, but he's done a lot since then. But the reason why I'm covering Jeff Fay again is because I've been doing some DVD hunting and I've actually hooked out all of my, well, not all of them. This is not exhaustive of all my Jeff Fay movies, but I got a decent amount of my DVDs out of storage that feature Jeff Fay, and I was going to run through them because I'm dead excited about them. He's an actor you probably know from The Lawnmower Man. He's also in, was it Planet Terror? No, it was the other one. No, it was Planet Terror. Yeah. And Machete, and there were a bunch of other films. He was a very good actor back in the 80s, and then he kind of went into DVD trash, but he was quality acting in DVD trash, and he could elevate a good bad DVD movie quite a lot. And that's what I'm looking at here, is pretty much a wall of good bad DVD movies. I'll start at the top and work my way down because it starts with a strong one, and that's Operation Delta Force. This was a franchise that turned out to be, I don't know, five films in length, none of which are connected really. I think there's a couple of characters, but played by different actors that are in different movies. But Jeff Fay and Ernie Hudson starred in the first one, and it's a quality action flick, to be honest. It's a cheap action flick, but quality one. Epicenter was a wee earthquake film with Tracy Lords and Gary Daniels, where he plays the villain. That was good fun. It was edited together from a bunch of different movies, you know, the way they like to do that. And back in DVD land, you'd get action sequences out of Metro or something like that, or Air America, and they threw that into another movie. A cheap movie, so they don't have to do an action sequence. Psycho 3, which is great. That's one of the best series of sequels. All of the Psycho movies are actually quite strong. Newcomers was a ropey drama. The Lawnmower Man, which I mentioned before, is often thought of as a terrible movie, and it's not the best movie, but it's a really interesting movie and a very interesting cornerstone to special effects and CGI. Darkman 3, he was the villain, and also he was Darkman in Darkman 3. I think that's a strong series of films that really paved the way for actually the direct-to-video sequel. I think Darkman 2 and Darkman 3 were the first back-to-back video sequels made for a film or for a big film. Backfire was a decent enough action film with Keith Carradine and Karen Allen. Wasn't too bad. Blue Demon, bad shark movie. True Blood, oh, I can't remember that now. To Kill For, I haven't seen. The Sweeper, Sweeper's one of those good old-fashioned PM entertainment for it and crap. Execution of Rima Graham, that was a good TV movie. I think it was done live with Morgan Freeman. It was one of his first projects, and it's worth checking out for a good, strong GFA performance. Time Under Fire, terrible. Terrible direct-to-video sci-fi hook'em. Scorpion Gigantus, again, see Time Under Fire. Icon, Frederick Forsyth's mini-series with Patrick Swayze, it had a good cast. And Maniacs, one of the movies that I would say is a rock-solid 8, 9, or 10. That's not rock-solid, but it's a very, very good movie. It really took me by surprise at how good this was. It's Jeff Fay and Leslie Easterbrook, where Jeff Fay and Kelly Waymire play two escaped mental patients who go on the run. And it's essentially Bonnie and Clyde. And it's really funny. It's action-packed. It's quite dramatic. And the last few moments, will actually bring a tear to your eye. I remember watching it a couple of times, and each time I was thinking, this really is just a good movie. So that's one to check out if you have a chance. Maniacs. So it's Maniac TS. Yeah. So there you go. That's a quick and uninformative rundown of a bunch of Jeff A movies that I have sitting beside me. I know I have more, several more out in my storage shed, but I haven't got to them yet, and I will do soon. Anything you want to add?
Under the Dome, I'm trying to track down where I would have seen him. He was in three episodes in Under the Dome, and I did watch all of those, but I can't.
Play the cop.
Yeah, he played Sheriff Howard Duke Perkins. And also he was in Lost. And he seems to have been in an awful lot of Lost, 34 episodes.
Yes, he was, yeah.
So, but again, I can't picture him in it. Frank Lapidus, his name was. But 34 episodes is probably two series, I think, of Lost. So he wasn't in all of it, for sure. And I can't, to be honest, I can't remember what I picked out last time when you were talking about it before. But Inferno, I thought, was the other Inferno. The
many movies called Inferno.
Yeah. Well, forget I mentioned that then. And that's about it, really. I have looked through, and I can't. It's just not someone on my radar, and I don't think he will be on my radar anytime soon.
Fair enough.
One of the differences between you and I think, Gareth, is that you just go for these, no, not just, but you go for these action men, all hero kind of, you know, men of action and men with the emphasis on the word men, you know. And when I'm looking for someone that I want to kind of follow, if you like, I tend to just go with females and not with males. So what that says about you, I don't know. but yeah, I think you're just drawn to, you have this thing about all action heroes and male actors, and I'm just the opposite. I'm more likely to focus in on female ones. Not that I exclude all males, but
Well, that's an interesting point, because I actually raised that in one of the reviews. I can't remember if it was The Underground or Hijack or there was another action movie that I reviewed, because I said in one of them that Jeff Faye didn't make very many action movies. I always thought he would make a pretty good action hero, but he didn't do that many. He ended up playing like a villain more often than not, because I think Justified, he was a villain in that as well. And they just brought him in, and he did good villain roles or deeper, more intricate roles with a lot of baggage, and he just has a brooding intensity about him that really factors through into the roles that he plays. But he decided to make himself a bit more available, so now he doesn't do the whole Hollywood thing that much, unless it's a friend asking him to do it. But he prefers to just move from independent film to independent film, where he just has one set fee. It doesn't go up, it doesn't go down. It's just that if you want me. Bruce Willis essentially did the same thing, but his set fee was, I think Jeff Faye's set fee is like $50,000 per film, and he'll be there for like a week, whereas Bruce Willis is $1 million a day. So, you know, you get a quality star if you need a quality star to come in for a week, or if you can afford it, you can have them for the 8 weeks of a film shoot or whatever. So he knows he'll bring his A game to whatever it is you are making, even if it's crap, absolute crap. And some of these are absolute crap. Day of Redemption is particularly bad. And that Dark Hunters, that was bad too. Yeah.
As I say, the emphasis was on the word men. And while you were talking, I reviewed all the ones that you brought to the show in directors in 2025 and actors in 23 and 24. And all of them are men, except for one. There's one exception, which is Sigourney Weaver. But other than that, all of them are men. And it's almost the opposite for me. So, anyway, just an observation.
Fair enough. Okay. You're saying that I like men. Right.
Yes. Anyway, yeah.
They're my second favorite sex. Yeah. Okay.
Fandom Focus. How do you say his last name? It's not Fahy.
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 Okay. Have you got anything else to say about Jeff?
No, that'll be that. I'll do a woman next time and that'll please you, won't it?
It was just a casual observation. But, you know, some people are blokes, and some people are not, I suppose. And we are different. Everyone's different. I'm not. Right. While you're on a roll, go into private screening and tell us about your choice that you set us for that.
I'll have a go. Okay. Well, I figured that we'd have a wee look at a film that is just, it's arriving on, was it Prime? I can't remember. It was about 2 weeks ago I watched it. Called yeah, Normal. Prime. And it stars Lena Headey, Rena Jolly, Jess McLeod, and a bunch of other females. I think there's an old lady as well in there too. I believe there's some gentlemen there, but I wasn't paying any attention whatsoever. Maybe you can tell us about them. But this is a fairly entertaining little action yarn about a substitute sheriff, which is highlighted in the film, who is supposed to do 8 weeks or something in a small town called Normal in Minnesota. And everything goes a bit nuts, and the Yakuza come to town, and they have to, you know, defend the town. Well, not really defend the town. It's a difficult plot, actually, to put into words, because now I'm thinking about it, I'm a bit challenged. I'll read it. It says, it centers on a temporary small-town sheriff who uncovers dark mysteries after a local bank robbery. Well, that's a bit cryptic, but
the Yakuza had all their guns and gold and stuff in the in the local bank's hold, didn't they?
They did, yes. And it's difficult to say without giving away what happens in the last half hour. It's difficult to say how things pan out in the movie. This film is, if it was made in the '80s, it would be made by Canon. That's probably the best way to describe this. It's a modern-day Canon film. It doesn't strive to do anything particularly new or exciting. It has a novel plot twist to it. That's about it. It just does gunplay. It does wisecracks. It does a little bit of humor. It has an action hero that you can relate to, something that I adore, apparently. And it's got a moose.
We'll
and mooses
that,
are
no.
quirky.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that moose is funny, wasn't it?
It was. It was a film that it didn't try to be anything other than just being an entertaining action film. And in a way, nobody kind of reinvented something. It reinvented Bob Odenkirk as an action hero. This, and he did Nobody 2, which I don't think was anywhere near as good as Nobody 2, or this. I would say this was easily the middle of the three films. And it's just refreshing, and it's fun to see Bob Odenkirk actually embody a proper action hero after we've been wowed by the fact that he can do an action hero in Nobody, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
I quite liked it, although I'm not going to watch it again. I think once is enough. There's no unique charm to this. And I would say the same about Nobody as well. I don't feel the need to return to this at all. There was nothing in it that really just made me want to come back to this. It's certainly not Die Hard. It's certainly not any of those kind of grand films, grand action films that people celebrate. And you know, it's nice that it's set in the snow. It's nice that it's got a bit of a Fargo kind of sense of humor to it, with a bit more action going. So I think if you're into that, you want to see Die Hard meets Fargo, then this is your film. But you know, obviously I'm the kind of person who's going to enjoy this no matter what. It would have to do something really, really horrendous in order for me to go, no, this is woeful. But it's Ted that I feel, because he can be a bit hit or miss, because the female cast isn't extensive. So enough, he might enough. Not have been able to get through it.
I think I agree with what you said totally there. It was just a kind of light entertainment thing, more of a comedy than anything else, which kind of puts it into a place for me, as you know, with American comedies. But I really like Bob Odenkirk. I think he's great. And it's all stupidly far-fetched, of course, and a bonkers plot. If there ever was a Friday night after the pub film, this would definitely be it. Imagine rolling in with half a dozen of your mates. So what should we put on? Let's put this on. And you're just still half cut, and it would just be a laugh, and you would laugh your way through it, I think. My concern, going back to what you were saying about Bob Odenkirk, though, is that I mean, I'm sure that the professionals on these film sets are looking after people properly, but Bob Odenkirk, I hope he had a kind of double for pretty much all he was doing. He's got a recent history of heart problems, so much so that they postponed the whole making of Breaking Bad, no, not Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, for a while. And on the face of it, he's kind of leaping around here from, you know, being chucked across a room. And you know, I'm sure that they must, as I say, be looking out for him. But, you know the movie business much more than I do. Do you think that that is something they would be very aware of?
Well, if he was at any risk of having a heart attack, then they probably wouldn't have insured him. So he's got to have a clean bill of health so he can pursue this sort of thing. And they're not going to do a Roger Moore with him, because it's all shot in 4K, high definition kind of stuff. So if they do have stunt men running around pretending to be Bob Odenkirk, people will tell. I'm sure he has a number of stunt doubles for the... Well, there wasn't anything particularly over the top. You know, he's just doing kind of fight sequences and things, and they're fast cuts, so it's probably easier. And I would say that's something that a lot of movie studios now, like Netflix, because let's not forget that Netflix is a movie studio more so than a streaming company now. Mm-hmm. You pay for access to their studio catalogue, not for their extensive library of titles. I've forgotten my point completely. They would be looking for ways to be able to make a big action movie as cheaply as possible, but also keeping it as shiny as possible. So not going and doing a Jeff A style action movie. They would be wanting to go out and make something and cut every corner possible in order to bring home the most low rent, high concept action film that you can get. And I think they're actually managing to do that, where you get something like Beverly Hills Cop, where it has bigger action sequences, but they can film them in such a way that you can just you buy that it's a bigger action film, but the action sequence may cost a fraction of what it used to cost 10, 20 years ago, whenever Paramount and 20th Century Fox were off making Con Air and The Rock, where they actually had to blow up, you know, buildings and things. And, you know, I was banging on about Terminator 3 quite recently, about how that big action sequence of the crane just destroying a whole front of shops and office buildings and things, how that came to be. And you can't do that now. You wouldn't see that in a big movie now, but Netflix and things like that would have a way of being able to shoot that effectively and shoot that cheaply without us knowing.
And what's that got to do with Bob and his health?
Well, the action sequence, the big fight sequence at the end where he's in the kitchen, isn't it, with the villain. It's cut and shot in such a way that it would be as minimal as possible, right, where they blow stuff up, where he has to actually perform big physical stunts and things like that. There wasn't that many. You know, it's not like Bruce Willis leaping around on top of the Nakatomi Plaza.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't not enjoy it. It was okay, just not my kind of thing. I was watching it for Bob, really. And he, because you know how I like male actors. The
elderly male actors.
The best bit about it, I thought, was the scene in the restaurant. If you're going to watch this, anyone, the scene in the restaurant, which is really funny, towards the end. And, of course, the moose. I thought the moose was great. I thought they might do more with the moose, actually. And I tell you what else I thought they might do more with was Henry Winkler. Because,
yeah,
blink and you miss him. He was in about three scenes, I think, and they were very short scenes, and he was gone. So I don't know what that was about, but, yeah.
I thought they were going to be chucking a gun into his hand and having he and Bob Odenkirk go at it. You know, maybe that's why they cast someone not of a similar age, but of someone of age who can actually, you know, be a foe for Odenkirk to go up against.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I'm gonna give it half marks. Well, as half as you can get out of 15. I'm gonna give it 8 because it's only half good, but just because it's not my kind of thing, and I've got to be led by what I think and how much I enjoyed it. So I did enjoy it, but only 55% or whatever it is.
Well, I'm gonna go with the other half then. I'm gonna go with 7.
Ah, wow.
Because 8 and 7 is 15, I think you'll find.
I just looked 13. No, 8 and 7 is 15. I just looked up Henry Winkler to see how old he was. 1945, so that makes him 81, is that right? Yeah.
That's the same as you, isn't it?
Wow. But, right, okay, so this has got 15 then. So that puts it in the company of Irreversible, The Grey Man, your favourite, The Lost Showgirl, Warriors of Fortune, and Mother Android. Oh yeah, I forgot about that. So yeah, down in the about 25% of the way up the table. So not bad, not bad, Bob. But you can do better.
Yes, he can. I don't wonder what's he got next on his plate. I haven't seen. He did, and this and Nobody 2 came out around the same, or in the same year at least. He's got one upcoming, The Making of Jesus Diabetes. I don't know what that is. Okay, he's got a comedy in the pipe.
He's obviously in demand, isn't he? So, yeah, but I think that they'll be cautious of his health personally, but then that's just me. Perhaps I'm going too over the top about that. We want to protect young Bob, old Bob. Right, my turn to choose next show, and this is a bit of a risk, frankly. It might be a bit of vomit fodder for us, but for me it'll be nostalgic vomit fodder. And you might better watch it with your family, certainly your wife, then about your son. The new Little House on the Prairie, which has come to Netflix, 8 episodes it is, and it's all there now, as you can binge it as you want. This version is a direct adaptation of Laura Ingalls Wilder's classic novels, rather than a straight remake of the Michael Landon TV series, which is good. I mean, it's good, it's not a remake of that. The tone drops, the pure, wholesome, cozy town vibe of the 1970s show right from the start. Instead, it positions the family's departure from Wisconsin and their settlement near Independence, Kansas, as a gritty, high-stakes Western survival story with a much greater emphasis on the harsh realities of frontier life, wildlife, unforgiving weather, and the physical exhaustion of building a homestead from scratch. When I read that, before I read that, I thought to myself, yeah, this is going to be really sickly sweet and horrible, and I'll watch it for 5 minutes and then give up. But actually, I think it's worth a go, because reading that, I think it might be different and better. And I haven't seen any reviews of it yet. So I think we should have a look at as many episodes as one can stomach of that for next time. Do you agree?
All right. Yeah. You've actually written above this in big red letters. Nothing vomit fodder.
Well, that's what I said, yeah. I said it might be vomit fodder, but at least it's nostalgic vomit fodder. But it might not be for you, because you're younger than me, and so you didn't grow up, you didn't go home from school every Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock and get stuck into Little House on the Prairie, and I did.
No, but it was on TV, and I was able to go, oh, I'll just press a different button here. Let's try 2 or 1 or 3. Let's stay away from Channel 4 for the next hour.
Okay, well, we'll talk about it off air. If you don't want to do Little House on the Prairie, we'll choose something else.
No, I'll absolutely give it a try.
I don't want to upset you, because I know how upset I can make you, and I wouldn't like that.
That's all right. You just inferred that I was gay on the podcast, so...
Nothing of the sort. Let's move on quickly. Theme Treats is next, and it was your turn to pick something very topical.
I went for football. Yeah. Teams playing sports and things. Football is not something that I particularly follow, although if I was a wee bit distracted there because Argentina are currently playing England, and I have highlights beside me just following to see what's happening. But yes, the football is quite appropriate because the World Cup is currently happening, and I figured we'd pluck out a couple of worthy football or if you happen to be in that American country that seems to have a problem naming this sport where you kick a pig's bladder around with your feet, to call it soccer instead. Shiloh soccer. Shiloh, why didn't I think of that until... Well, I tried, did everything to avoid using the word soccer, and I ended up forgetting a very important football movie. But yes, Shiloh soccer, there's one to go for. But I picked out a little British film called When Saturday Comes, and it stars Sean Bean at the peak, and a bit of a spoiler, he doesn't die at the end of this one. This is it's more drama than it is comedy. It's not very funny. I thought it was a comedy when I went in to see it. I was quite looking forward to it. It's moderately humorous, but it's just a good old-fashioned and highly thought of British football drama. And it's worth checking out if you want to sit down and watch a wee bit of footy drama style. But one thing that really did pull me in, and it pulled my wife in as well, was Ted Lasso. It was a superb...
Okay, before you move on, I'd just like to say that looking at the trailer of this, it's all about Sheffield United. I never knew that. I used to be a Sheffield United supporter when I liked football back in the day, 30 years ago. And I was not aware of this at all. So I might watch it just because it's the Blades. The amount of time I spent at Bramall Lane, I can tell you. Anyway, carry on.
Okay, right. I didn't feel I needed to mention the team. But I'm quite interested that you were a fan of Sheffield United, and that was enough to make you stop following football. Right.
No, okay. That's another story.
fair enough. Ted Lasso, 3 seasons of... in exceptionally enjoyable and infectious comedy drama. There's a bit of drama to it. There's enough drama to keep you interested to coming back as the hooks are on there. It's a very feel-good TV show, and I think that's really important about it. And it was one of the last things that we saw Anthony Head in. He was in a good few episodes of it as well. Ted, you'd love it for Juno Temple. She's in there.
Okay.
Hannah Waddingham, she is superb in this, and gorgeous, and everybody falls in love with her quite quickly. Jason Sudeikis plays the title character who... initially is actually kind of grating, to be honest. First few episodes, you want to kill him. But I think that's part of the series, and he eventually grows on you because everyone gets won over by him in the end. Brett Goldstein, and I don't think he's any relation to Andy Goldstein, but he is quite good, although his gruff voice does get a bit irritating as it goes on. I don't think he's quite as scary as he's supposed to be. But I think this is a really good show, and it's one of those ones that was so clever to bring itself to an end before it overstayed its welcome. Charming, wonderful film, or TV series, and it's on Apple TV, I think it is. So it's worth checking that out if you haven't seen it. Ted?
Yeah, I think that looks good. And we have spoken about this on the show before, and I think that I went away to look at it and see, but I never did. And I think the reason I didn't is because I'm not particularly interested in football, and I wasn't particularly interested in the American football link either, and I thought, yeah, I'm not going to like this. But actually, now that you've spoken about it, I think there's more chance that I will indeed watch it.
Do that then.
Talking about TV, firstly, Porridge, 1979, the spin-off film of the TV show, which was another creation by Dick Clement and Ian Frenaise. With Ronnie Barker, of course, Richard Beckinsale, I can't say it, Fulton Mackay, Brian Wilde, the whole Peter Vaughan as Grouty, which is really funny. And it's a spin-off film of the TV show, in which they set up this celebrity football match. And it's just outrageously funny from start to finish, as there's a subplot going on where the prisoners are using it as an opportunity to try and all break out and escape. And Fulton Mackay, he's playing his usual role, but he's also the referee, and he's trying to keep order. And it's just riotous. It's really funny. There's no canned laughter, I seem to remember, which makes it quite different to the TV show. But I think it survived regardless of that, and it is funny. So that was my kind of TV pick, if you like, even though it is a film. But my main pick really was the one which I guess most people will know, Escape to Victory, the 1981 football kind of Second World War thing with an incredibly star-studded cast, where actually very similarly to Porridge, they set up this football match, and many of them are Americans and don't know how to play football, but they set this football match up, and there's a big showdown at the end where they're playing the German national team in Paris, I think it is, and again they got this plot going on to all escape while this thing's going on. So Pelé's in there, Michael Caine, Sylvester Stallone. Michael Caine plays the lead and the organizer of everything. Bobby Moore and Osvaldo Ardiles, loads of footballers from the past. Russell Osman, Mike Summerby, John Walk. And each of these people had greater or lesser roles in the film. Some of the footballers that clearly didn't want to be involved in acting much, so they just kind of stood around quite a lot, and the proper actors took it on. Max von Sydow was in there as the major of the Germans, and he's really good. It's just a really good rip-roaring World War II film that we've kind of lost. When it got to 1981, we kind of done all the 1950s, 1960s largely World War II rip-roarers, and this kind of came in afterwards, and I think it was done really well, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's a good yarn, and a World War II prisoner of war kind of story, which is just really, really engaging. I guess you like this?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I think it's, well, it's nowhere near as good as The Great Escape. For our American listeners, it's just called Victory out there. It's not Escape to Victory, I don't believe.
Right.
But, yeah, I remember the escape sequence. I remember it being just so exciting, seeing the way it happens.
Yeah.
I don't want to say the key word here. So, spoiler, it's one word coming up right now. The pool. Hang on a second, that was two words. I've never forgotten that from when I was a kid. Just how that happens. It was so exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my pick. And I could easily watch that again. I haven't watched it for quite a few years now, but I could easily go back and watch it, and I might even do that.
I think you should, yes. And I'm going to do that as well. I'm going to watch it with the boy. Yeah. It's an important one. He wants to watch The Great Escape soon, so we'll watch a double bill.
So that was football, and that was your choice, and we've done kind of justice to that. And that was very topical. And what's the score now? No score?
Score?
Argentina, you said, didn't you?
I closed it because I was getting distracted and was having trouble listening to you.
Yeah. Well, that's nothing new. Right. My choice for the next show, which is Isolation and Seclusion. And there's millions of films I know that will fit the bill for that, but humour me, let's play along. Isolation and Seclusion. The world is your oyster on that one. Let's move quickly into the main feature. And I'm going to choose the film that's kind of doing the rounds at the moment called Obsession, which I think we covered on our Coming Soon, didn't we?
It's nil-nil, by the way.
Nil-nil. Very exciting. Very exciting indeed. A nil-nil draw. That's all we need. right. Obsession, 2025. A chaotic supernatural horror, this is, from writer-director Curry Barker, who I don't know, I'm afraid. It's a wild, atmospheric ride about a romantic entanglement and romantic entitlement, and the terrifying reality of getting exactly what you wish for. If you remember, it's about this guy called Bear, B-E-A-R, who is a kind of timid, nice guy. And he falls in love with this woman who he's been long-standing friend with, called Nikki. But she's not interested in him. He goes into this novelty store one day to buy something else. And he ends up seeing these things called One Wish Willows. And he buys one of these, and the way this works is that you make a wish when you open it, but the catch here is that you only get one wish, and not only one wish per One Wish Willow, but one wish per person. That's it. You get one in life. So you can buy 100 of these things, but you only get one wish. And that is significant to the plot of the film quite deeply. Okay, so he breaks this thing open, as we saw in the trailer in Coming Soon, and he wishes that Nikki would love him more than anyone else in the world. That was his wording. Mm-hmm. And the film then is about the fact that that dream that he had came true, but it soon got out of hand, because loving someone more than anyone else in the world has its downside as well, it would seem. Yes. So it spirals into a kind of claustrophobic nightmare really for him. Nikki, at first we stay with them, and so they have a nice kind of, you know, time getting to know each other and shagging each other and all the rest of it. But very soon she starts to get violently jealous and manipulative, and she just goes kind of manic, she just turns into this kind of hyper jealous person who brings out that behavior in violence quite often. So Bear tries to kind of wriggle his way out of this. So this is why, this is when he finds out that the trouble is that you could, the only way you could, once you've made a wish, the only way out of it is if you die. So the rest of the film is about, the rest of the film is largely about her and her behavior. And that's done really well. Lots of spooky stuff going on as well, when she creeps around because she's been jilted, or she thinks she's been jilted at one point. Lots of kind of gory special effects when she gets violent with people, largely him. I won't say any more, because it pans out to a finale, of course, and it's a really enjoyable watch. I thought it was really done well. Navarette is the girl. What's her first name? Can't remember. But anyway, that's her last name. She in that's right, yeah. In every scene she's in, which is most of the film, she's really, really good and really convincing and spooky and scary. And they kind of, you know, that they photographed her well, they filmed her well doing what she's doing. It's very silly in some respects because of the, you know, nature of the supernatural stuff, but it's dark and it's lots of fun. And it was a really good watch. And I think you should put it onto your list if you haven't already seen it, Gareth.
It is absolutely on my list. I know my stepdaughter is very excited about it. She's been busting at the seams for me to get it somehow, but she hasn't. I haven't got around to watching it yet.
Okay.
Yeah, it does sound good. And the director, Curry Baker, he is going to be handling the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he's got a lot on his plate that involves human meat.
Yeah, it's a good watch, though. Go for it. What's your first one?
Well, kind of foreshadowing the end of the show, obviously we lost Mr. Sam Neill recently, and I felt like going back and revisiting one of my favourite films from his entire filmography, and I watched it with my son on Saturday night. Wasn't it Saturday night? Saturday or Sunday night? I've lost track because it was the 12th of July here, the Battle of the Boyne, so we're off work Monday and Tuesday, so the last 5 days have been a bit of a blur. I watched The Dish from 2000, this was actually, it was quite an important film to me because I picked it up when I was in Australia. I have my little copy of my DVD behind me, which was the Australian release of it. And I just really got into it. I had rated this as 10 out of 10 on IMDb, which I think was a little bit high. But it is just a beautiful little simple comedy that's a true story about how the largest satellite dish in the Southern Hemisphere was manned by a bunch of men, oddly enough. There were no women there. There were a lot of sheep, though, Ted. I'm sure you would like those. But they had to handle the moon landing whenever the Earth was pointed in the other direction. So you had a big satellite in California handling one side, and then obviously on the other side of the world, you have the one in Australia handling the rest. And it's the tale about how they lost the signal and had to get it back, and how they had to defeat the odds with whenever an impromptu gale came along that meant that the satellite dish could end up getting destroyed. It's not riddled with excitement. If anything, it is totally imbued by Sam Neill's performance, where he wears a cardigan, he has a pipe and a cup of tea, and he muses. He talks with a little bit of wisdom. He is very polite and enjoyable. There is one scene in which there is a little bit of a misunderstanding and tempers are lost, but it is over so quickly that you barely even notice it. It's just a lovely little movie. I can't recommend it enough. It's funny as well, but it's very lightly funny, where they don't want to make a mockery of what happened there by turning it into a zany comedy with Jim Carrey or something like that. It has, I think it's Billy Mitchell, who plays one of the men who is working in the satellite. He's just a bit of a wisecracker, and it's that kind of not cutting, but it, just a little more savage than normal kind of humor that the Australians are really known for. And the three guys who are up there and the surrounding people who are affected by everything that's going on, it's just a beautiful little comedy, and it passes by so easily. It's so smirksome, witty, and it's just so human. It really is. The director Rob Sitch had done The Castle, which is a film I heartily recommend, a number of years before that. And I remember hiring it out on video with a bunch of friends, and they hated it because they thought it was going to be like a Jim Carrey comedy, and they didn't get that, and they just ripped it apart. And I think, if anything, years ago I reviewed a film called Rams, which starred the star of Castle. I've forgotten his name. Canton, I can't remember his first name. And Sam Neill as two warring sheep.
Herder, yeah,
people.
I remember you talking about that. Yeah,
yeah, and it's along the same lines as that, where it's just an enjoyable little comedy that mm-hmm. that doesn't try too hard to be funny. It doesn't try too hard to thrill or entertain. It just tells a nice story with a little bit of wit around it to keep you plugging along. It's colourful. It's beautiful. It gives you plenty to think about. There's some good relationship and advice and things in there. It's really well made. I can't give it 10 out of 10, but I would happily give it 8. It's cool. Really nice. Have you ever heard of it or seen it?
Yeah, I think you spoke about it when you did Sam Neill before on the show, in another kind of capacity. And I looked at it then, and once again, never got round to watching it, but I will now. I promise. He looks very young in that. Anyway, we'll come to that later, won't we? Talk about Sam Neill, because that's been a very sad week for everyone. We'll save that for later. My second one is Widow's Peak, which is a Apple TV creation, a dark comedy horror created by Katie Dippold. It's 10 episodes, and I have dubbed it as being a kind of Fargo in terms of darkness and feel, but it's mixed up with a kind of folky horror thing, which is really funny. The kind of folky horror you get with witches and New England and the 1600s and Sleepy Hollow and that sort of thing.
Salem and all that, witch trials.
Yeah, all of that sort of thing. It's set on this island in Widow's Bay is the island. That's the name of the island. And there's no Wi-Fi. There's barely any cellular signals or anything, as you might expect. And the story follows Tom Loftus, who is played by Matthew Rhys. He plays this cowardly mayor. He's not born on the island, but he's got the job as mayor of this island, determined to boost tourism. So think Jaws here. Tom ignores local superstitions and successfully lures in the crowds. Unfortunately, when the crowd arrives, the curses that are centuries old start to show their faces. And then suddenly we've got a whole bunch of kind of weird and odd things going on, like self-ringing bells, and a killer clown pops up, and there's a predatory sea hag in the mix. And then there's a mind-controlling fog that kind of comes down. But There is some logic to it, and the logic does get explained about the past, and it does that thing where they sometimes have one whole episode based around what appears to be a completely different story. So one of the episodes goes back to 1600 and something, and we see that's all acted out in that 1600 time, and then that's that whole episode. It's a really interesting kind of technique. And the next episode you're back into the present day, but you've got that bit of background. So there's lots of kind of horror stuff going on. There's this apart from all this spookiness happening, there's this storm coming, which has been cooked up by these kind of spooks and legends and stuff going on from the past. And they all, the whole of the population of the island, have to go into this hotel for the weekend to sit out the storm. The production values are really, really good, as you expect from Apple, really. And the pacing is really good. The whole of the cast is really brilliant. Matthew Rhys is really good. But I think that the woman that plays Patricia, one of his staff, steals the show whenever she's around. Kate O'Flynn. I'm not sure if you know her, but I had a look up some of her other work, and she's been very much in all sorts of Brit comedies and dramas and all the rest of it. And when I saw her face, I thought, yeah, I've seen you, but I just couldn't quite. But do you know her?
I know her face. Oh, she's Death in Paradise, right? Okay.
Yeah, she's been in lots and lots of Brit stuff, and she was really, really quirky. She played this character who was really funny throughout, but also very spooky and very strange. And anyway, so all of the cast pretty much are really funny. They've also chucked in loads of Easter eggs. I mentioned Jaws just now, but there's nods to all sorts of things. And here's my little list. The Shining, The Witch, Sleepy Hollow, I spoke about earlier, Fargo I did, Carrie, IT, that's the whole Pennywise thing for the clown, Psycho, Clockwork Orange. There's even a South Park reference in there. And certainly The Fog is in there as well. So loads of stuff to unpick while you're watching it. And look behind people on walls as well, which is really good fun. Because when Tom is trying to convince the local people to follow what he's suggesting, behind him on a blackboard there's a shark in chalk mark, exactly like it was in Jaws. And so that was just one little Easter egg, and it was just really, really funny. Really, really good series. There's a second series been green lit, apparently. And I think that this is so good that it's even better in many respects than Severance, frankly. I think that this is going to be Apple's kind of thing and the big flagship for them going forward, or certainly for this year. Really, really good. Recommended highly. Watch it.
I will, yes. It is on my list. I will get into it as soon as I finish watching what I'm watching at the moment, which is something else that I can't remember. But yes.
Cool. Okay.
All right. The second thing I want to bring to the show is a new horror film. And it's a creature feature, as I do love my creature features. But this one's a wee bit different. There's no sharks. Don't worry. But it stays in the water, and it's not crocodiles. No, it's hippos. It's a movie called Hungry.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a little unpretentious creature feature that does exactly what it says on the tin. This isn't another one that wants to reinvent the wheel or anything, or try to be Jaws. It just goes out to give you some fun thrills and to have a good time with whoever you happen to be watching it with, as you know, 90 minutes rolls by. What we see is a group of tourists that head out into the Louisiana swamplands, into the Bayou, or the Bayou, And they're going out to see some gators, for which they only see slightly munched up gators. And they are suddenly put upon a giant hippopotamus that... it's kind of standard size hippopotamus. They don't do a Jaws thing or a Megalodon sort of thing.
Oh, right.
It's just a big hippopotamus because hippopotamuses are big. Yeah. And you have a rather agreeable bunch of people. There is obviously the dick that no one can really like, and they're designed to be dislikable or unlikable throughout the film. But they're not entirely unlikable. They have their reasons and they're kind of justified. The rest of the group are all quite likable people, and I actually found myself thinking, right, who is going to be the next victim? I hope it isn't that person because I quite like them. I hope it isn't that person. I hope it is. Oh, we need to see people die, but I don't want any of them to die aside from the dick. But they can't kill the dick off this early. And then you have Joaquin de Almendi, who is from Clear and Present Danger, a rather well-known Portuguese actor whose name I absolutely butchered there. I do apologize. But you see his picture, you'll know him. He's in The Fast and the Furious. He's the villain in Desperado. I think he's the villain in Behind Enemy Lines as well, the Gene Hackman film. But he's in there as well, playing the kind of great white hunter, doing his old Robert Shaw kind of thing. And it brings it to it. He makes it his own. He's not Robert Shaw, but it's enough to make you go, well, yeah, there's a wee bit of a nod there. And the director, writer, James Nunn, who I don't know if I've seen anything else he's made. I know he made the one-shot series with Scott Adkin and Tom Berenger, and he did a couple of the Marine movies, which were not great, but he just seems to really want to make this work, and he sat down and thought about it, and he's thought about making an entertaining film, or maybe he's made a film that he wants to see, and that's what he's walked away with. The special effects are good, the creature feature effects are great. The ending is something that I will try to speak of without spoiling anything, but I felt it was a wee bit limp. I do feel that it was kind of they didn't want the same reaction to Jaws, you know, where everyone was scared of Jaws or sharks and people wanted to stay away from the water because of sharks. And that kind of kills the point of the film, because you like a creature feature where there's a mad rampaging sloth that's coming after you and it's going to kill you, and then you take it down in some unusual way, and I don't want to spoil anything, but things don't quite go that way, which is a bit annoying. But I suppose you could say that if this is a success, they could easily get a sequel out of it, but it'll have none of the unique charm, and it'll be a lot more Jaws 3 or 4 than it is the original Hungry. Have you seen or heard of this?
No. I think you probably mentioned it to me privately as it coming along, and I really fancy it because I think, as you suggested there, it looks like it's kind of not crappily made like a lot of them are. and a lot of we've got used to this kind of this shark fodder, which you never know what you're going to get, and 80% of them are just shite. But this actually looks like it's been quite well done, so I shall be tracking it down when I can, and I shall be watching it. Good shout indeed.
Yeah, you can rent it off of either Prime or Apple, I can't remember which. Okay. But it's the kind of thing that I can quite easily watch with my wife. She loves a good creature feature. She always prefers it to be Bigfoot, but anything that preys on human flesh, she seems to really enjoy. So she liked it.
A hippo's a bit different, isn't it? Because I don't know that it's been done before in this kind of way, has it?
I don't think so, no. I can think of giant pigs and things like that, but I can't think of they usually crop up. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, where they were making the Great White Hunter movies out in Africa, you'd have a lot of hippos attacking people and that sort of thing. But
I meant to say to you earlier, how is this hippo not in Africa?
They do explain that, and they explain it rather well. But there is, and it. Wow, I remember thinking during that scene when they are explaining it that it didn't sound hokey, but I can't remember exactly what my thoughts were. But I was pleased enough with it.
Very good. Yeah, I look forward to that enormously. I can't wait. I shall watch it. Right. Okay. Then. So now it is time. Now it's time for not looking at Madison Davenport too long, but going to Coming Soon.
Yeah. I'm not going to put that in the cover art. It's a bit too young, to be honest. Anyway, yes, the two girls in it did look young. Maybe I'm just getting older. And now that, you know, 25-year-olds, you're thinking, ooh, are they too young? Yeah, you are worried. Right. Okay. Yes. Coming Soon. We'll start with the biggest movie on here. And to be honest, it was really hard limiting these down because there are so many trailers out at the moment. I just had to, you know, randomly pick more so than curate. Digger. This seems like an important film that's going to be arriving. It's a comedy satire of those. Angry Swedish pig dogs, English pig dogs, American pig dogs, capitalist pig dogs, whatever you like. It really is a tongue thoroughly in cheek comedy about the most powerful man in the world who embarks on a frantic mission to prove he is humanity's savior before the disaster he's unleashed destroys everything. So it's Tom Cruise doing a somewhat of a comedy role, but it very much is a wink and a nod to a lot of things that are going on. It reminds me of something like Doctor Strangelove, you know, that kind of satire. What did you make of this, Ted?
I didn't like the look of it. It looked just like a pile of American tripe, frankly, in my usual way. I was just a bit sad, really, because it looks like what's behind it, the actual storyline, could have been made into a decent thriller. But they just, as is so often the case, they try and make it into a comedy. And I get the whole tongue-in-cheek thing and all the rest of it. I don't know. This is exactly the kind of film that I can't stand and I would just not watch because it's just not attractive to me. Sorry.
Fair enough. Well, Tom Cruise is in a fat suit, or I don't believe that he would put that weight on himself, but he looks pretty good in this film and I think he's chasing an Oscar. I think he wants one before he gives up. He's not going to give up, but anyway. The Dog Stars is a dystopian sci-fi post-apocalyptic psychological drama thing that I've watched a couple of times over the last number of months, these trailers coming out for this film. And I think it's actually that I'm not entirely sold on the lead star, Jacob Elordi or whatever. But I'm a bit more impressed by the supporting cast, because you've got Margaret Qualley and Guy Pearce, Josh Brolin and Alison Janney in there, Benedict Wong as well. Benedict Wong. What did I watch him in recently? Oh, The IT Crowd. Yeah. And something else. Was he in something I watched? Yes. Yes, he was. That I didn't mention. Right. Yes. So this is a post-apocalyptic, I don't think it's an action movie, really, to be honest, but it's about a virus that wipes out humanity. Survivors face roaming scavengers called Reapers. Protagonist Hig, which is the lead character's name, a pilot, survived the flu but lost his wife and has to deal with the emotional drama of that. And I don't know, somehow get people to safety. It's directed by Ridley Scott. I've completely butchered my description of it. Ted, what do you think of this?
I think it looks like, from the trailer, that it's got the makings of something quite good. It's clearly good production values have been applied. It looks like it's been well shot, and the acting looks good. I mean, it's easy to get tired of these kind of post-apocalyptic things, but you'd like to think that Ridley Scott was at least going to kind of do it a bit differently and a bit well, better than some of the tired ones. So I'm up for this. Yeah, I'll give him a chance, and I think it looks okay.
No, I'd agree. I'm not entirely enthusiastic because I can't get behind the lead guy, but I haven't seen him in anything really, and the Wuthering Heights just really didn't do anything for me. I didn't finish it at all.
I didn't start it.
Yeah, but I didn't see what everyone was going shit about him for. But I haven't seen him in anything, so I can't comment. That's not fair. Right, next up is a little Irish film called Bad Apples that stars Saoirse, doesn't it? No, Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse
Ronan. And directed by Jonathan Etzler. And it's about a struggling primary school teacher who begins to make some questionable decisions after one of her students is injured. The first half of this trailer looks like it could be a really good comedy that quickly slips into horror, but there's some good drama here and a decent thriller under the main part of the film. I think this looks like it could be something that really does stand out. What do you think, Ted?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the trailer makes this look really engaging and really well done. And I think that she's really good. I just clicked through to the IMDb page, and they've laid this out quite strangely. There's no trailer, and they've listed her name somewhere down the bottom, and most of the actors have not even got pen pictures, which probably means that they're unknowns. Fair enough, and a lot of them are kids as well, because it's in a school, I suppose.
Well, the other day, whenever I was putting this together, Saoirse was up at the very top. That's where I kind of stumbled over her name, because she wasn't there, and I was thinking, oh, God, have I got the wrong film?
Anyway, yeah, I think this has got real potential, and I like the look of it, and I like her. So, yes, I should look forward to this. September the 18th.
Yes, that's right. And it's probably worth pointing out, The Dog Star is coming out on the 27th of August, and Digger on October 2nd. Right, moving into the better area of trailers. How long is it to Halloween? It's just round the corner, so we've got some horror films aplenty. We're going to start with She Saw Us, which is probably the lowest budget of the bunch here, maybe. This is about when four friends discover a cursed two-headed doll in a remote forest. They unleash a vengeful witch who traps them in a place from which no one has ever escaped. Ted's bedroom. It's coming.
My static when it's hot.
September 4th, we're seeing this. It's directed and written by James Knight. And it really actually looks kind of fun. I know horror movies can look a bit bland, and we do get so many of them. It's difficult to actually ascertain which is going to be decent or not. But I've got a funny feeling this might be quite good. And it's coming to cinemas. That's a good giveaway. Ted, what do you think of this?
Right. Yeah, I'm not at all convinced by this. It comes across from the trailer as a kind of student project to me. The acting and the script is all a bit ropey. And you mentioned some weird ADI, didn't you, in the notes here?
In the trailer, yeah. The trailer seems to be redubbed, but that's possibly because the sound hasn't been fully processed for it.
Right, okay. And the whole kind of central theme of this being centered around a spooky double-headed doll thingy, which really isn't very spooky. There's one scene where there's a girl standing in a kind of hallway and her head is twisting around and she's completely over made up and overacting the thing. It just felt as though this was a student project, low budget, and a bunch of guys have been thrown into this house and said, try and make a horror film with this. Here's a double-headed doll. This will get you going. Start a story around that. And that's how it came across to me.
Well, it apparently has a budget of around $3 million, which is quite high for a UK horror film. So I don't know. I'll reserve judgment until I see it. I think this looks quite good. Okay. It's got a novel approach anyway, or a novel storyline too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Next up is Hope, which is, oh no, you can take this one. Take it in terms.
This is a Korean alien creature feature, and which we know that the Koreans do quite well. It's Hope. It's called Hope. It's 2026. A mysterious discovery is made on the outskirts of a remote harbor town. The residents find themselves in a desperate fight for survival against something they have never encountered before. It looks like another Korean disaster stroke creature feature thingy, but it does actually look as though it might be quite good. The special effects look as though they're okay. And if they can make it as well as a lot of the other stuff they do in this genre, then I think it should be cool. There's not a zombie in sight though. This is creature from outer space by the looks of it, and not zombies.
Yeah, I've got a real feeling of A Quiet Place from this.
Yeah, that could be right.
Did they not do this before?
The creature whips across and catches someone off guard. And then in that forest where the horse... Anyway, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think we've done it before, have we?
I vaguely remember saying that before.
Oh, right.
This reminds me of...
Well, there's a bonus for our listeners. They get it twice.
Well, yes. Well, we could have put something else in here. Yeah. Some film's going to flop because we didn't feature it. There you go. Right. Next up is back to Ireland, where we have Feed. This is about five. This is the bit that puts me off. These first four words. Five social media influencers. Mm-hmm. There we go. That's that over with. Spend a weekend in a forest retreat, but inadvertently awaken and confront the world's first vampire.
Hurrah.
I felt this looked like a damn decent trailer, and I'm gonna be sneaky here because I've read your notes on it, and I'm gonna say it's quite a modern trailer that I feel will appeal to the youth that this is targeted to.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. But what annoyed me about this trailer was that it was edit. No scene in the no clip in the trailer was more than about 2 seconds long, and it was just jumping all over the place. It made me feel sick. But presumably the film will not be like that. That was just the trailer, and I do not fancy something that is going to be annoying. But I'm hoping the film won't be annoying, so I'll give it a chance. But I too, the social media influences that bit kind of put me off a bit, but I was switched back on by the vampire bit.
That's kind of why I put it in, actually, because you have such a hard on for vampires these days, it's just another one for you to go for.
You can't say that on our family friendly podcast.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I meant to say such a raging.
Move on. Oh yeah, this next one is, this one looks really good. It's a bit art housey, but it's a film called Werewolf, Werwulf, 2026. It's coming to the cinema in December, so there's a bit of a wait for it. Medieval Britain, A mysterious creature stalks the foggy countryside. Think Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Transforming. Yes, oh, a Jabberwocky, yeah. Transforming local folklore into a terrifying reality as villagers face an ancient supernatural threat. This is a Robert Eggers film. And to me, it looks really, really good. But as I say, I think some people might put off because it's a bit arty-farty, I think. It's the way in which it's been, you know, shot, and there's lots of black and white stuff going on. And, you know, and atmospheric, I would like to think, and spooky and sinister and dark. But some people might just, you know, not fancy the arty-farty bit. Are you? Did you see that in it?
Oh yes, I am genuinely excited about this. I think it really looks. I love The Witch. I'm not that big of a fan of Nosferatu or The Lighthouse, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen Northman, but I'm really hoping that this is going to be even darker and bleaker than The Witch. It actually reminded me of a little film from years ago. I haven't seen it in such a long time, called Begotten, which is a wildly intense horror film with a particular unique style. And this seems to have that style, but kind of brushed up, washed up for the multiplex. It also reminded me of Nightingale, which was a
great.
Yeah, not quite as... which isn't quite as dark and bleak as this is, but no. I think... Yeah, the three of them could be a nice little triple bill. The Witch, the Nightingale, and then Werewolf.
And Willem Dafoe's in it.
That's true, yes. You can't go wrong with a bit of Dafoe.
Oh, indeed. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, there's a bit of a wait. It's obviously been brought out for Christmas, I reckon. October. What's it called? Halloween.
Halloween. That's the one. I'm wondering if the title Werewolf is a way that, you know, it was maybe written back in the 13th century when this is set.
Yeah, yeah. That, quite possibly.
You know, because old English kind of thing.
Yep.
Maybe. Right. The last one here, and I've actually just earlier on finished typing up my little article on this for my blog tomorrow, is Crystal Lake, which is a prequel to the Friday the 13th series that sees Pam Voorhees, who has been unable to shake the grief of her young, sickly son, Jason, tragically drowning in the town lake almost a year before. When two strangers arrive at Pam's door, digging into her past, a disturbing chain of events are set in motion, leaving the townspeople of Crystal Lake wondering, who is Pam Voorhees? So this is a precursor to the Friday the 13th series of films. And it's quite important how this sort of slots in, given you need to have seen... I don't want to be spoiling the original Friday the 13th film because it's such a great climactic scare. But this kind of... It shoehorns its way in before that, and it explains the events that leads up to that, and how we got Jason Voorhees. But it's a different approach. This is very much a psychological drama from the looks of things, and they're really exploring what's going on here. And we're going to see a bunch of the classic characters coming back. They're obviously
it's a being series. Recast. It's not a film. Right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's a Paramount 10-episode series.
Right.
Because we get to see the classic characters coming back who, well, I think most of the actors have passed away, and most of the cast of the original Friday the 13th are not going to be in this yet because of the reasons that this is set before that film. So yeah. I'm really quite excited about this. I think it looks great, and if they're fleshing this out to make it much more of a resolute series, then there could be a lot to deal with here, where the Friday the 13th films were really quite surface level slasher films. There wasn't much underneath the surface beyond that first film. They just turned into, you know, a kill frenzy. You just looked forward to, what's he going to kill this next teenager with? Oh, look, they're taking their clothes off. They're about to die. You know, that whole joke came along because of it. Whereas this really looks to be trying to bed down in and develop that third layer, second, third layer of drama in here that might make kids scared to go back into the lake. I'm excited for this. I can't wait.
I think you're right. I think that it's worth a look, definitely. And now that I know it's a series as well, I think I'm more enthusiastic about it just being another churned out, you know, sequel, prequel in this case. The trailer makes it look half decent. So I'm up for it too.
If you think about it, it's such a time we live in. You know, a couple of days ago, we just got the announcement that there's going to be a new Nightmare on Elm Street. Friday the 13th is hitting small screens. Evil Dead is currently in the cinemas, and Halloween has rounded out a new trilogy that they've just finished there, and I think it was produced by Bob Odenkirk, if anything, there, Ted.
Whoa.
Maybe, I can't remember. But it's the classy slashers are all kind of back, and they seem to be doing quite well.
Cool.
It's great.
Right. Okay, there's a bumper crop then for coming soon. And before we go, we're going to have the final curtain. So settle down now and get comfortable in your seat. Nice drink for the next 10 minutes of Gareth's appreciation. Actually, you posted on your blog, didn't you? A blog post about Sam Neill, didn't you?
I did, yes. Yeah, I was a bit taken aback whenever it happened on... Was it Monday morning? It was the 12th of July itself, or 13th of July it was. And Sam had passed away after, he was cancer-free. He had a rare type of blood cancer that had very progressive tests and trials and surgeries done, or, you know, medical terminology being thrown in there willy-nilly because I'm so good at it, and he was declared cancer-free. However, it just appears that he didn't quite survive it all in, because, you know, cancer takes everything out of you. A lot of people who have cancer end up passing away from maybe a heart attack or whatever before or after, because of the stress and the worry and the concern, the anxiety that goes along with it. So it's a terrible condition that unfortunately he suffered from, but he managed to absolutely stomp all over it in a very Sam Neill way. He prevailed, but we lost him, and he has an incredible filmography that I would urge people to go out and really explore, because he's done everything. He was initially born in Northern Ireland, just up the road in a town called Omagh, where his parents were, I think his father was a military, and they were stationed there. And then they went back to New Zealand when he was about four. And his name was originally Nigel, not Sam. And when he started school, he changed it to Sam so that he wouldn't get bullied by other kids. But he made his first big splash in the film industry in a little film called Sleeping Dogs, which is it's kind of a dystopian style thriller set a wee bit in the future, and they're clamping down in a sort of 1984 kind of way, and he ends up being a reluctant resistance fighter. And it was really an impressive film, and it shot him off to fame, and he started making a lot of other films. There was one I picked up thinking, because I have a big collection of his films that I'm gradually bringing in from storage, and I picked one up that sounded kind of funny, called My Brilliant Career, And I bought it on DVD. I brought it home thinking, oh, this looks like an interesting comedy. But it was a period drama, and it was really boring. But my mum loved it. She thought it was great. He popped up in The Sullivans as well, which is a long-running Australian drama that I'm sure you know, Ted, don't you? You've seen The Sullivans?
I know what it is. I don't think I've watched it, though.
Okay. I remember during the summers, whenever I was off school, it would be on early morning, kind of cup of tea for the family sort of thing. Then he got cast as Damien in The Final Conflict, or The Omen 3, if you like, which was him breaking into the American film industry. But he also had Attack Force Z, which is a big, not really big. It's a bit of an oddity. It's Sam Neill and Mel Gibson, and it's a wartime action adventure where they're sort of plodding through the forest. I've only seen it once. I watched it a few years ago, and I don't remember it very well. I don't remember thinking it was particularly great. But and Sam Neill has a bit of a lack of presence in the film. But I need to watch it again. But he starred with Isabel Adjani in Andrzej Zulanski's Possession, which is a horror film from another world. It's a phenomenal film. It is just so mind-bogglingly freaky. And the two of them give unbelievable performances, where he plays a spy who believes his wife is having an affair with a man in a different room of the apartment block they live in, and it turns out it's something entirely different, and it gets messed up. Now, Ted, if you think about the Irreversible, the subway scene in that, this has a crazier subway scene.
Right.
That it's worth watching. It's not for everyone, but I absolutely adore this film. It's a phenomenal. And Studio Canal did a beautiful box set that I managed to get as soon as it came out, because I think I've owned it on every medium since VHS. Yeah, since I first saw it. Something else, that film. He did Ivanhoe and a little Martin Sheen starring political thriller called Enigma, where he played a Russian operative who was trying to track down the Enigma machine. But it was quite a good role for him as well. It was fair enough thriller. It was all right. But ITV got him in, and he played Riley, Ace of Spies, which is a TV series I remember watching with my parents because I was so into James Bond at the time. And Riley, Ace of Spies is actually one of the main influences for the James Bond series. Ian Fleming was very up to speed on Sidney Rosenberg, who would be Sidney Riley, the British spy. And it's a great series. I heartily recommend it. I have a beautiful box set of it on DVD, but it hasn't had a proper 1080p release in a long time, or at all, sorry, in a long time. He made tons of other films after that, but obviously, you know, Dead Calm and The Hunt for October.
I came just before Dead Calm. That's where I was going to leap in, because I think A Cry in the Dark was the first time I was aware of him.
That's what I was looking for.
Right. So that was just before Dead Calm. But from then on, looking through his filmography, lots and lots. Not much before A Cry in the Dark, but after that, loads. Yeah. So carry on. Sorry.
Well, I think whenever people talk about Sam Neill, they always go for the big names. Obviously, the Jurassic Parks and The Hunt for Octobers and In the Mouth of Madness and Event Horizon and all that. They always go on about that. But if you have a look in between those films, you'll find some really, really interesting little roles that he played. I reviewed a film called Fever on the blog that you should go and have a quick check out, because it's such a standard direct-to-video action thriller thing that both he and Armand Asante bring quite a bit of gravitas to, and it's much better for it. In 1987, he or 1986 it would have been, he tested out for James Bond. It was between him and Timothy Dalton. And I think I've said a few times that Cubby Broccoli had to make that decision. He was able to make it instantly. He chose Timothy Dalton. But I know that I would have been sitting there really scratching my head. I don't think I could have ever chosen between Dalton and Sam Neill for James Bond in The Living Daylights. And if you go onto YouTube, you can see his audition tape for the role. So you get to see him play James Bond. But on the back of that, he made a little film called Hostage that obviously plays into that casting of Bond, because, you know, I think people wanted to see him as James Bond, and he plays a somewhat kind of James Bondian type spy with Talia Soto from License to Kill. It's a decent little action thriller. It's quite cheap, low budgety thing, but he's brilliant in it. There's the piano as well, which
the piano that's where I was going to jump in as well. Yeah. The piano, I loved that film and I watched it so many times, and I just thought it was brilliantly made. That was my next point of call, really.
Well, actually, I think of the piano. Everybody talks about Holly Hunter and Harvey Keitel, and Sam Neill's actually left out of it. However, I only watch the piano for Sam Neill. There's no other.
Harvey Keitel's good.
Yeah, he's good. He's good, but Sam Neill steals that film away, as he always does.
And Holly Hunter.
England have just scored. That's the point we're at, Rena. After that, he made The Rainbow Warrior, which was a film that came out the same year as Jurassic Park. Rainbow Warrior was Greenpeace's boat. And he and John Voight plays a Greenpeace guy, and he plays a lawyer, I think, who's investigating the bombing of it, things like that, as to what's happening through insurance reasons or something like that. I can't really remember, but it's actually quite a good TV movie, and I think it's historic, it's interesting. He was in that film with Elle Macpherson and Hugh Grant and a bunch of models called Sirens, where...
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, every man, I think, remembers that. he's a good performance in that. And Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book, he made soon after Jurassic Park, which was the live-action version, I think one of Disney's first live-action versions of something that they'd already animated. And it was a really good film. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Restoration with Meg Ryan and Robert Downey Jr., Hugh Grant, I think, was in that as well. That was a decent film. I can't remember too well. But Children of the Revolution was another one that I actually have on DVD here. It's a Stalin-based comedy, because you make comedies about Stalin, with F. Murray Abraham playing Stalin. It was really good. It was really funny. It's worth checking out. And that was the same year as In Cold Blood. Ted, we've seen that, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. We watched that, didn't we? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I think we did.
On the last show.
Yeah. It's come back to me now. Yeah, go on.
Then with Willem Dafoe and Victory and Sigourney Weaver, Snow White, A Tale of Terror.
Oh, yeah, that was really good. I like that. Actually, I can't remember him in it. He played Frederick Hoffman. Was it a small part?
It is a fairly small role, but it was a busy year for him because he was doing Event Horizon that year. So, yeah. He was doing your favorite TV show, Merlin.
Merlin, that was great. The Channel 4 Merlin was just brilliant. I loved that. I had it on the VHS tape and it got worn out.
Yeah, I remember it coming out and... I was in school. No, I wasn't. I was at college at the time, and everyone was talking about it. It was a good quality TV production that everybody got into. Mm-hmm. I don't remember him in The Horse Whisperer, but he was in that. I've only seen it once, and that was on a small screen because my daughter wanted to see it, and I put it on because he was in it. So, yeah, I don't quite remember it. But that year, 1998, he made a film called... it's called The Revengers Comedies here, but in the States it's called Sweet Revenge, and it's got Sam Neill, Helena Bonham Carter, and Kristin Scott Thomas, and it's a fantastic little comedy. very much worth watching if you can track it down. It's out there. It does surface every now and again. Have you seen that? No. You like Helena Bonham Carter?
Yeah, I do. And I think that when I was doing a Helena Bonham Carter thing a couple of years back, I think it was, I had that on my list, but I haven't got to it yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to go through all of them because it's basically me reading IMDb out to you, and that's a bit mean. But I would say some of the highlights for you to check out is The Zookeeper from 2001 is phenomenal, where he plays it's set in the Second World War when the Germans are bombing the zoo. He has to get out the animals and the people who are affected by it. It's quite difficult to track down. I have it on DVD.
I had this in the show as the main feature. I'm sure I did. Yeah, I remember that. That was really good, that film, The Zookeeper. Yeah. I think I've got it on my blog. I think I reviewed it. It's on my blog, yeah. Carry on.
Yeah. Everybody loves it who sees it, and it doesn't really do much anywhere. I don't remember it getting a proper release or seeing it anywhere other than my DVD. That's it.
Right. Yeah.
Oddly enough, he was in the remake of Framed, which was a TV series starring Timothy Dalton about 10 years before. Timothy Dalton played the Rob Lowe part, and then I can't remember who played. No, Sam Neill played the Timothy Dalton part. Yeah, that's right. I think it was David Morrissey played. Was it David Morrissey? Played the Rob Lowe in the TV series. I don't know. I'll have to go back and watch them again. But Framed is quite an interesting little film about a con man and a kind of a FBI agent, I think it is, and a con man who are trying to work each other out. Dirty Deeds with John Goodman is a good comedy hitman movie. Dr. Zhivago, the TV series remake, is all right. I remember watching it on TV, but I didn't take too much away from it. Perfect Strangers, he made with Susan Sarandon, should have been good, but I don't think it particularly was. Wimbledon, he was in that. I had to watch that in the cinema. Didn't think too much of it. Could go on about it. The TV series The Triangle, now that was good fun. It was a wee sci-fi TV show about the Bermuda Triangle that I'd recommend. Wait, no. Perfect Strangers and Irreversible. Irresistible. I'm getting those two mixed up. Yes, Perfect Strangers wasn't Susan Sarandon. Irresistible was. I can't remember who the female was in Perfect Strangers. Rachel Blake. I'm just getting those two mixed up. I watched them in quick succession. Merlin's Apprentice was the follow-up TV series. Do you remember that?
No.
Oh.
I remember you trying to put me onto that, and I never got to see it. But, yes, added to the list now.
Okay. He did a lot of sort of big blockbustery type things, like Under the Mountain and The Daybreakers. What was the Legend of Guardians? That was an animated film as well. There's a little film he did with Willem Dafoe called The Hunter, where Willem Dafoe was down in Tasmania trying to hunt the there's been a sighting of the Tasmanian tiger, and he goes like, that was a really good film. My wife remembers it very well. That was one of her recommendations. There was a pilot for a TV series called Alcatraz that was kind of a sci-fi time travel thing that only got one season, unfortunately, but it was decent. He was in Escape Plan, which I always felt wee bit duped because I went to the cinema to see that, and I was so excited because Sam Neill was in there. I know it was Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I was actually there for Sam Neill. He's only in it for about 5 minutes, and it's such a small role that it could have been played by anyone, but it was still good that he was there. I suppose I guess he kind of wanted to be in that. He knew how big that film was going to be, so why not do that? Peaky Blinders, first two seasons of that, I stopped watching it after he left the cast, but it was worth checking out. Backtrack with Adrian Brody was a decent enough little thriller, horror, thriller. Halt for the Wilder People is one that a lot of people are talking about at the moment. I'm glad that's getting a bit of a resurrection, because it's a really charming little family movie where he plays an old grizzled hunter who goes out with a kid into the wilderness, and the two of them just grew to enjoy each other. You'd probably like that, because you'd probably identify with the old grumpy man who lives out in the middle of nowhere.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Sweet Country, actually. That was a pretty good film with Brian Brown. I haven't seen it in a while, but I watched it when it first came out. Yeah, that was a kind of Western, outback, Australian, dusty thriller that's good. It's good. And Rams, obviously Rams, I mentioned earlier on. And there's a load of other things in between. Thankfully, we still have a lot of films that we can go back and investigate, because he was such a prolific actor. He made so many different films. You're going to be continuing to discover his films on into the next number of decades, because there is so much to it. I mean, I have a problem where I think I've probably seen about, I'd say maybe 50% of his filmography. And I'm okay, because I've got plenty to go. Whereas someone like Ray Liotta, I know I've only got like 6 films left I need to see, and that's me done with everything he's been in. Sam still has 2 films that are due to come out, one called The Last Resort, and he's going to be in the next Godzilla X Kong film, Supernova, which is, I don't know, Godzilla 7 or something like that. But he'll obviously elevate it, and I think I'll have to sit down and watch that, because that might be his very last appearance in a film. Yeah. Any highlights, Ted, you want to point out?
I think I've been chipping in, really. What came across a whiz, though, when you saw him being interviewed or being, on camera, away from in role, was that he just always seemed to be such a nice bloke. You know, he comes across as being a nice, caring, kind, friendly, and he's got this warm, round face, which just portrays the same image as well, which is just like Mr. Nice Guy. And you're right, he's just done so many things. His filmography is just completely stunning, right back to 1971, and, you know, never been out of work, pretty much. And everything I've seen him in, I've totally enjoyed. Obviously not as much as you, in terms of 50%, but I've certainly seen a lot of his films. And, I really think it's very sad. 78 he was.
Well, actually, it's important to point out that he wasn't just an actor. He was also a director and a writer and a presenter, too. He presented a number of different TV shows over the years. Space, I remember, being a very important one back in the mid to late 90s. It had some groundbreaking special effects for TV at the time. I have it on DVD. I picked it up because it was something that I remember sitting down on a Saturday evening and watching with my dad, because it was all science. You know, it was really exciting science. He recently did a TV series about explorers in the Pacific Ocean, you know, like Captain Cook and all those types of explorers. And he followed their trails across the Pacific and I suppose the Atlantic Ocean as to where they went and the horrible things that they came across and the weather and all that. And it was deeply fascinating. I never finished watching it, to be honest. I found it difficult to get all of the episodes and sit down and watch them. I watched the first 2 with my son and he really enjoyed them. And we just never watched any after that because life kind of got in the way. But one thing I would actually suggest people do is if you go onto YouTube and just type in Sam Neill Red Meat and watch some of his Red Meat adverts. They're really, really funny. Where it was a government-sponsored drive to try and get people to eat more red meat and the reasons for it. And he states the reasons, and it's done all done in a very quirky, funny style. And then he does a little dance at the end of each of the episodes. It was really cool. I really liked that. It was really endearing. And it's fun to see someone like that have so much fun. His personal blog and his Instagram and things were really helped people through COVID. It gave people so much to watch, and he shared a lot of his not opinions, but his whimsical views on life. And he took people on the tours of his vineyard and all of his pets, and we got to see his pigs and things like that. It was just beautiful to see. And when I left Instagram, it was one of the things that I really missed, because he really was a charming, interesting, funny, and thoughtful man. And it really saddens me. You hear people from time to time, whenever someone passes away, they might have something negative to say about them, I think whenever, say, Tommy Lee Jones was to pass away, I don't think there'll be too many people coming out to say how wonderful he was. But Sam Neill, I don't think anyone could say a bad word about him. And I don't think anyone could actually say that he wasn't a loved actor. Everyone who saw him on screen really just enjoyed seeing him. And because of Jurassic Park, so many of the generation were introduced to him in the way that, say, Harrison Ford was in with Han Solo, or Charlton Heston as Ben Hur. You know, it became a face for a generation, and everybody loved him as Alan Grant, and they'll never forget him. And even my son, he's never really seen any other Sam Neill films, but whenever I mentioned to him that he passed away, he knew instantly who he was, and that, you know, he starred in Jurassic Park, and it was the lead guy from Jurassic Park, because everybody likes him. Everybody likes him in that role. It's a very likable role, and he was superb in it. He was an excellent actor, and I'm really going to miss seeing him in new films. That's really sad.
Yeah.
So it's July 13th at 78 years old, and farewell, Sam Neill.
Mm-hmm. You're so involved with that you've forgotten that there's someone else in Final Curtain.
Oh, yes. It's someone I added in as well, which I was a bit sad about too. It was Joanne Pettet, who played Mata Bond in Casino Royale from 1967. She was also in 67's The Night of the Generals, and a wee William Shatner film that I had on VHS called Pioneer Woman. She was also in Double Exposure, which is a film I picked up on DVD because it looked enjoyably crap, to be honest, a 1980s thriller. But as Mata Bond, I realized how much I really enjoyed her as an actress. She made that film. She was very beautiful. She was very funny, I have to say. Was a Cool It Charlie. It's just a little thing that she did. She just fit in perfectly into that film, despite the fact that she was surrounded by so many massive stars like David Niven and Peter Sellers, Ursula Andress, Orson Welles, and Woody Allen, William Holden, John Huston. There were all these names, and she was kind of in the middle, and she had such a big, juicy role to push through. And she was terrific, absolutely terrific. Do you know Casino Royale, or do you know Joanna Pettit?
I can't remember, because I certainly have not heard of this lady, Joanna Pettit, but Casino Royale, it's so long since I saw it, I can't remember. Sorry.
No, that's okay. You're allowed to not know someone. her father, or her mother, was called Joanne Jane Salmon.
What?
Turns out she is your aunt. So this is your cousin.
Send me some money then.
Joanne Jean Salmon, any relation to you?
No idea. I the only person that I know with the name Salmon is a writer in America. Well, I don't know him personally, but that's the only inference instance I know of it. No idea.
Okay. Fair enough.
Okay, we're done, I think. Yes, we knew that was going to be a bit of a Sam Neill special. So thanks for going through that, Gareth. Very moving indeed. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another show. GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find me. And our website is projectorroom.co.uk. Let us know what you've been watching in the MeWe group. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And I hope that you'll join us again in the Projector Room.